too often, women are left out of the history books. Most women in the United Kingdom never learned about the struggle for the right to vote in the 20th century. For the first time ever, that story is being told on the big screen. The feature film Suffragette, which just opened in Bay Area theaters, focuses on working-class women who took militant action to gain basic rights. On today's Your Call, we'll be joined by Suffragette director Sarah Gavron and Emmy-winning writer and playwright Abby Morgan. Join us after the news.
Hello, this is David Austin with the BBC News. Prosecutors in Pennsylvania have charged the American comedian Bill Cosby with aggravated indecent assault. The 78-year-old, who was once among the world's best-known entertainers, denies the charges. Laura Bicker in Washington has more.
This is the first criminal case against Bill Cosby. Andrea Constant, who worked with a women's basketball team at a university where he was a trustee, says the comedian drugged and violated her at his home as she asked for career advice. Prosecutors reopened the case against him after damaging testimony was released where he admitted during a civil lawsuit that he gave drugs to women with whom he wanted to have sex and paid them afterwards to keep quiet.
Switzerland's Justice Department says it's frozen approximately $80 million in bank accounts linked to the corruption scandal engulfing world football's governing body, FIFA. Swiss officials also announced that they handed over the first batch of evidence requested by US prosecutors investigating alleged bribery over the right to screen big international tournaments. Adrian Hobart reports.
Earlier this month, the US Department of Justice published a dossier that detailed allegations of widespread corruption and bribery in Latin and North American football, claiming that as much as $200 million had been misappropriated by officials. 30 people have so far been arrested or indicted since May, including a number of FIFA vice presidents. These documents will help the US authorities to build the case against them. And as part of the US-Swiss operation, 13 bank accounts containing $80 million have been frozen.
The president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, has threatened to fight off an African Union peacekeeping force if it sets foot in his country to deal with unrest. Here's Anne Busby.
It's the first time President Nkurunziza has commented publicly on the African Union's plans to send 5,000 peacekeepers into Burundi, even without government consent. Under his country's constitution, he said, foreign troops could only intervene at the request of warring parties or if there was no legitimate government in place. The president's decision to stand for a third term sparked the wave of political violence that has killed hundreds of people since April and displaced tens of thousands.
The US Space Agency says the weather pattern known as El Niño, which has caused extreme conditions in many parts of the world, could be as severe this year as in 1998, which was the strongest ever recorded. Meteorologists say a fierce storm currently pushing north in the Atlantic is causing highly unusual temperatures in the Arctic. A Rwandan priest accused of genocide and crimes against humanity 2 decades ago has been sentenced to life imprisonment by the country's high court. It found that Jean Uwinkindi had led attacks against Tutsis. He was charged with ordering the killing of about 2,000 people who had sought refuge in his church. World News from the BBC. The US military has accused Iran of carrying out what it called highly provocative rocket tests last week near American warships and commercial vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. A US military spokesman said Iran fired several unguided rockets about 1,300 metres from 2 US vessels and a French frigate. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, says 2016 will be a disappointing year for global growth. Writing in a German newspaper, Ms. Lagarde said rising interest rates in the United States and the economic slowdown in China were contributing to uncertainty. A married couple in Britain have been given life sentences for planning bomb attacks in London. Mohammed Rahman used social media to discuss targeting the London Underground and a major shopping centre using the name Silent Bomber. Richard Lister reports from the court.
Mohammed Rahman and Sana Ahmed Khan stood silently in the dock and showed no reaction as the judge gave them both lengthy prison terms. During the sentencing hearing, Rahman's defence counsel said although his client maintained his innocence, he was a Walter Mitty-like character who'd been a heavy drug user and was completely disowned by his family. It emerged that Ahmed Khan wrote to the judge expressing her remorse, but Mr. Justice Baker rejected those sentiments, saying she had funded the planned attack and he had no doubt they intended to target a public place.
Pakistan and Afghanistan, whose relations are frequently tense, have established a hotline between their respective military commanders. Pakistan's military spokesman said the two men discussed future meetings and improving coordination along the border. A town in Germany has banned the use of fireworks on New Year's Eve in and around migrant shelters, saying that the loud bangs could traumatise those who have fled war zones. The authorities in Arnsberg in North Rhine-Westphalia have also banned sales of fireworks to residents in the shelters. Those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For the first time ever, the story behind the fight for women's right to vote in Great Britain is being told on the big screen. The feature film Suffragette tells the story of the foot soldiers behind the women's struggle for equal voting rights in the UK in the early 20th century. Suffragette, which just opened in Bay Area theaters, takes place in 1912 and 1913, when the movement shifted its campaign from civil disobedience to militant tactics, such as smashing window shops in London's West End, vandalizing post office boxes, cutting telephone wires, and setting fire to empty buildings. The women were surveilled, beaten, imprisoned, and force-fed. Because of their activism, in 1918, British women over 30 who owned property obtained the right to vote. But it wasn't until 1928 that all women in the UK over 21 were granted the same rights. So who were these women who took part in the struggle, and how does their struggle resonate today? On today's Your Call, we are joined in studio by Sarah Gavron and Abby Morgan. Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, a film that focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. She has worked in TV, film, and theater for 17 years. And Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. They both worked previously together on a film adaptation of Monica Ali's book, Brick Lane. And Abby and Sarah join me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for making this film. I saw it and I loved it and it was very inspiring and I just wanted to leave the theater. And I wanted to start screaming about the attacks on abortion and reproductive rights in this country. I was really surprised to learn that this is the first time that a movie of this stature has been made about the struggle for voting rights in England. And I understand that the academics you both worked with told you that they were not surprised.
Yeah, they weren't surprised because it's taken years for women's history to be taken seriously in universities, that it hasn't been on the school curriculum. It's been marginalised, which is a symptom of inequality. It's a symptom of the fact that men are setting the agenda in that respect. So it felt important to resurrect this story, this key bit of our history that so changed the course of history, but also it felt very resonant with so much today.
We have sort of a similar film in the U.S., Iron Jawed Angels, which is about the suffragette movement here in the U.S. And after I saw that, I realized that I didn't learn anything about this. And I went to public school in Northern California. Abby, did you learn anything about the suffragette movement when you were in school?
I remember colouring in a sheet that a supply teacher gave me. And I remember working very hard on colouring in Mrs. Pankhurst's hat. But other than that, I don't have much of a memory. I mean, I think you brush upon it as you move towards the First World War and the history of that. And I'd adapt did Birdsong by Sebastian Foulkes, which is set in the First World War, and I realised how little imprint in my research had the suffragettes had figured. So for us, I think, as Sarah said, it was a chance to go and, you know, reinterrogate history, and it makes you very excited about other areas of history that you could now look at.
What about you, Sarah? Did you learn anything about this in school?
I didn't, and it was such an exciting story as well, not just an important story, but, you know, once we started delving into the research, these women who had gone to such great lengths at such great personal cost, who had faced brutality at the hands of the police and the state. It made you realise how hard fought for the vote was, and it just seemed to leap off the research leapt off the page as something that should be made into a film.
And Carey Mulligan, who is the central character in the film, she plays Maud Watts, a poor factory laundress. She told Time Out London that the mere fact that it's taken 100 years for this story to be told is hugely revealing. And she said she thought the suffragettes were basically women who marched down the street holding their flags. She didn't know much at all about the fact that they were beaten, force-fed in prison. The surveillance part of it was also amazing to see, because we are talking about surveillance in this country. And then to see the same thing happen back then, because the film took place in 1912 and 1913, was really incredible to see.
Yeah, once we uncovered the surveillance research, because the National Archives for the Police opened in 2003, it was a real revelation to realise that there'd been this cutting-edge sort of, you know, that they'd used cutting-edge technology to go out and pursue these women, that they perceived them as such a threat, that they had this whole unit put together to survey the women.
Abby, you both spent 6 years researching and working on the script. And when I was watching it, I wondered, because I didn't know much about the movement, what is fact and what is fiction? So can you talk about the research process?
Well, originally when we started to look at the research, I made the misstep of basing it on the Romola Garai character, Alice, who's the wife of a Westminster MP and a kept woman to a certain extent, whose own wealth has been subsumed by her husband, who's now taking control of it. And Maud was a character who came into the house. But actually, the more research we did when we focused on the laundries and the work, the lives of the working women, we suddenly realised these were the kind of voiceless women. These were the women who weren't necessarily able to financially write their memoirs and had such huge challenges placed upon them because of the times, that actually, as soon as we found Maud's story and started focusing on that, it became really exciting to us, because so many of the issues that Maud was dealing with, be it appalling work conditions, sexual violence at home and at work, custodial rights over her children, equal pay, access to education, these felt like 21st century issues. And I think the more we focused in on that story, the more relevance we felt it would have with a modern day audience.
So when you initially finished your first script, you realized at that point that you wrote the wrong film.
I think I did two or three of those first scripts. And eventually I had to just hold up my hands to Sarah and say, you know, we could make this movie, but is it the most interesting movie and is it the most important movie? And so to Sarah's credit, she trusted we would get there, and I threw it away and we started again. And I think it's been a process of making this is bespoke and interrogating every inch of it, so that actually there is a very strong factual article in terms of the history. We're looking at five very key moments in suffragette history, from this extraordinary period of peaceful protest in 1912 through to moving into the kind of extreme parts of the militant activism within the movement. But the composite of characters in the form of Maud and Edith Ellen, who's a pharmacist played by Helena Bonham Carter, and then Romola Garai's character, who's the wife that we discovered in that first draft of a Westminster MP, and then Violet, who is a woman who is really at the heart of the movement and is struggling to live with an abusive husband and raise four or five children. They were composites of real characters we found during the research, and it was about taking these fictional characters and making them collide with a kind of huge historic touchstones in suffragette history.
Talk a little bit about the research process and how well documented were the lives of these different women.
Well, when you dig, you find a lot, but it takes some digging, you know. I mean, academics have written some great books, but then we went into the archives in the Museum of London and the Women's Library, and there are letters and police records, and there are prison statements, and there are diaries, and there are postcards, and suddenly it starts to really become alive, you know, and you see all these little snatches of dialogue between these women and their testimonials of their working life. And we also, there's in the Women's Library, you can hold the purse of Emily Wilding Davison that she dropped at the Derby when she was hit by the horse. You can see the banners of the women's organisation that they embroidered so beautifully. So it was about piecing together all those bits and really understanding what their lives were really like.
And where did you find that information?
Well, I think we were really lucky in terms of the researchers that we had on it. And I think it was, you know, we brought in some fantastic female historians who came in. We've got Krista Kalman, who's an amazing historian, who really constantly reinterrogated what we were writing and tried to help us make it as authentic as we could. As Sarah said, there were the declassified police records that were opened in 2003, which were revelatory because they showed the level of intimidation, surveillance and effectively torture of these women. There was a medical historian who came in to talk to the actors, who actually had been force-fed himself and talked through the actual procedure and the medical illnesses and injuries that were inflicted on these women as a result of that torture. I mean, when you look at someone like Emily Wilding Davison, who was tortured 49 times.
Force-fed
49 times, which again, a form of torture, and a means to break down these women, then you know, it really hits you how incredibly damaging it was that these women sacrificed to themselves, both physically and mentally.
We also found some lovely things in the research, like we found a reel of film that had never been developed, and the producer, Faye Ward, decided to spend the money on taking the gamble and imagining it may come out blank. But actually, it was the close-ups of the women's faces at the funeral of Emily Wilding Davison. And then the production designer went to the company that had made the hunger-striking medals 100 years ago, and they reopened their factory essentially for us and remade the medals and wove the ribbons to make them.
And they're planning to keep making those medals now, which is great.
Oh, wow. What was it like working with the feminist historians and the academics? Because we get this in the United States. It's the white, powerful men write the history. Mm. And so I'm sure they all had very different opinions. I'm sure they were all very excited about this film and the potential it has to raise awareness, but I'm sure they all wanted you to do very different things.
You know, what's amazing about a piece of history that perhaps isn't as well documented is that it is owned and kept alive by this incredible kind of passionate kind of beacon of predominantly women, actually, although there were some very key men there as well. And, you know, for us, it was very moving, I think, when we started to meet some of the female historians, all those academics who'd written about it, and they were the ones who, you know, trawled eBay to gather together incredible collections of postcards and, you know, a suffragette paraphernalia and old suffragette articles, which became very important because those things become incredibly totemic. They really connect you. I mean, Sarah talks about the purse, and there was something so moving about seeing Emily Wilding Davison's purse that I know on a personal level, writing it, that was very much in mind. There were also, you know, of course, there were the historians who had very conflicting views. Say, for example, Emily Wilding Davison's reckless act of protest, you could see it out where she's killed by the horse. And that was very interesting to us because there was a documentary that was very recently made where they were able to restage, using CGI, the exact movements of Emily and how she would have positioned herself on the race course, because it was actually well recorded because it took place in front of Pathé newsreel. And that was fascinating in itself because it shows very clearly that she was raising her arms to try and put the flag, the suffragette colours on the horse. So again, you know, there were historians who felt it was an act of suicide. There were others who felt it was an act of protest. And we were able to really engage with the debate, but also constantly find another bit of information which would give us another POV on history.
Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, a new film that focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. It takes place in 1912 and 1913. Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. The film is now playing in Bay Area theaters, and you can also watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. So when I saw the scenes about Emily Wilding Davison, the first thing I did when I got home is searched her name because I wanted to know if she actually was a real character, and she is. And I also was thinking, do I want to give this away when we do the show? Because I did not see that coming. Mm. So talk a little bit about when you first discovered Emily Wilding Davison. Tell us about her.
Well, she's a character who's pretty well known in the UK. It's the one moment people know in the history of the movement is her protest at the Derby. But what we decided to do was lace her in to Maud's story and have them collide. And she's a fascinating character. I mean, one day maybe someone will make a film just about her. She's a maverick. She's quite unknowable. And no one quite knows her intentions. But she was someone who was incredibly committed to the cause. And as Abby said, she repeatedly hunger-striked, and she was force-fed almost more than anybody else, and went to prison, was in and out of prison. She was a governess. She did a degree and wasn't able to collect her degree because women at that time couldn't actually receive a degree. She was an incredible character. But in our film, she's peppered throughout. Yeah.
And also at that time, 1913, the marriage age was 12. Mm. And once a woman was married, she had no rights and really no say in her family.
Mm. That's
I mean, that was what was so powerful, I think, when you started to look at actually there's a, you know, the pressures that were on these women. And one of the scenes that I think really highlights this is you see a scene where Romola Garai's character, Alice, is arrested along with the working class women. And when her husband comes to bail her, she says, "You must bail the other women too." And he refuses. And she said, "It is my money." And he says, "You're my wife." And so it was this idea that this wealthy woman had married a man who actually had also colonised her money and her, therefore her independence. And so you realise that not only was it the working class women, but obviously the middle and the upper class women were dealing with huge sacrifices. You know, one of the big pressures for women of being members of this movement was the conflict it placed on their marriages, the threat it placed on their ability to be mothers, and the threat of losing their children, as you see within the film.
Right, because they are really sacrificing almost everything. And in some cases, at least with Maud, she wasn't really involved in the movement. Mm. And then once she became involved, her life changed overnight.
Mm. I think we wanted to capture the way it's often the ordinary women who change history, that there are these huge political shifts going on in a very internal way in Maud, that I think she's a woman who has been very bound by a very abusive relationship within her working life ever since she was a child. And actually, in witnessing this moment of civil disobedience at the opening of the film, that activates the point of change. And so what we're really watching is this woman going through her own very personal journey towards emancipation. But ironically, this emancipation also demands this militant activism, which is so far away from who she is at the beginning of the film.
Right. Do you know if Emily Wilding Davison was married and had children?
She wasn't, no. Oh. She was a single woman.
And so what was amazing about that scene and what she did, so she went to a derby in 1913. A lot of very wealthy people were there. Politicians were there. The king was there. And at first, they wanted to just pull out banners. It was two of them. Mm. It was Emily and Maud. Mm. That was the initial plan. Mm. But they couldn't get in front of the cameras.
Mm. Well, what's interesting, again, is that we will never truly know what Emily Wilding Davison was planning to do that day. It's thought that she travelled with two other women.
Okay.
But having said that, you know, there is the argument she had a stamp in her purse, which you would have had to write postcards to your loved ones if you were incarcerated, which is probably what she thought would happen after this act of protest. She had a return ticket, which people have often perceived meant she would plan to go home, except the return ticket was the cheapest ticket to buy that day. You know, we will never truly know what Emily Wilding Davison's plans were, but I think what was important to us was to show that, you know, her act, which was really did change the course of suffragette history. You know, although they did not get the vote for another 6 years, certainly for women over 30 who owned property, and then a decade later for all women, what it was it was the point where the media could not shy away, and they actually started to put that image on the front pages of all the news. And so it became the kind of pivotal moment where I think the world, and then subsequently Westminster, had to face that these women weren't going to go away and the depths of their despair.
And so she walked right out as the horse race began, and she stood right in the middle of the race. Clearly you're going to be knocked over within seconds and pass. And I was just curious, because she did have the flag above her. It was very small, and it fell on the ground immediately. Do we know what happened to that? Or
yeah, there's an amazing story. A man in the crowd went onto the race course, as did many of the crowd, and picked up that flag and put it in his pocket. And then he had a new baby daughter, and he wrapped the baby daughter in that flag and went to Emily Wilding Davison's funeral.
Were you able to find the news articles that covered her death and the articles that since the death galvanized so many other women?
Yes, I mean, it was covered on Pathé News footage cameras that were positioned just opposite where she did the protest, which I'm sure was strategic, we know was strategic. And then so that was broadcast around the world. And then it was also, yeah, front page news. And all those newspapers do still exist. You can go into archives and find them all.
And the extraordinary thing was that the horse lived and the jockey broke his collarbone and actually attended her funeral. And
also attended the funeral of Emmeline Pankhurst, which was in 1928. So, yeah.
And how did Emmeline pass?
She died of sort of old age, in a way. I mean, she'd had quite an exhausting life, and in and out of prison, and been on hunger strike. So she was frail, but she died in her 70s, 3 weeks after women got the vote on the same terms as men.
Meryl Streep plays Emmeline.
That's right.
And she's just this sort of amazing figure who appears once in a while because she has to be underground for fear of being arrested. Mm. What else can you tell us about Emmeline?
Well, she was an extraordinary woman. She was head of the movement. She had two daughters who, in their own right, became incredibly influential within the movement. I think the desire to cast Meryl in that role was to show how hugely charismatic she was. There's a wonderful bit of eight-second footage that Meryl cites as the kind of inspiration for that performance, which is completely silent but is an image of her first coming out on stage to talk to an audience. And it was before we knew about selfies and had a sort of self-awareness of how we looked on camera. But the thing about also about Emmeline was she was, you know, hugely charismatic in the way that she could become such a leader in the infrastructure, and also, you know, herself was incarcerated.
And when Emmeline was giving a talk to a lot of the women, and in fact they went to this rally knowing that they could easily be beaten, in fact many of them were, and jailed, she was clearly angry, and she said, all right, it is time to defy the government and be militant. What did that word mean to women back then?
Well, that came out of 40 years and more, really, of peaceful protest, of women trying constitutional methods to get the vote, peacefully petitioning the government and getting nowhere. You know, governments repeatedly broke their promises and the King's speech never mentioned it. And there was a kind of effective press blockade where the press didn't report any of the women's issues. And so it began militancy, which meant civil disobedience, direct action in a very small way by women resisting arrest. And then it turned into women going into prison, and then it escalated. But they, under the leadership of Emmeline Pankhurst, who advocated this strategy, they never harmed human life or targeted human life. It was very, very specifically targeted against property and lines of communication. So they'd go when there was no one around on the streets and firebomb pillar boxes, because that was a form of communication, and cut telegraph wires. And they did, in the end, bomb some buildings, but they were always empty. So it went, they took a lot of risks. Mm. But they also faced a lot of violence at the hands of the police and the state themselves. And no one ever died as a result of anybody's actions except some suffragettes themselves.
And the state wanted to be sure that no one did die, because then that would get a lot of media attention.
They didn't want a martyr, that's right.
Right. Talk a little bit about the level of violence, because it was pretty hardcore. I mean, they beat them bloody and they force-fed them.
Mm. I mean, some of the women used to actually make armour out of cardboard to put under their skirts and on their breastplates, because one of the tactics of the rabble rousers who used to be sent in by the police when there was a protest was they would twist the women's breasts, which was obviously very painful. The women, as we know, learnt jitsu, which was a form of, they felt they needed to protect themselves, and they clearly did. I think we based the character of Inspector Steed on a composite of two detectives at the time. And, you know, when you look at the way they systematically surveyed the women and constantly following them. And actually, there was the Cat and Mouse Act, which was brought in, which was an act which meant that the women would be arrested, and just at the point when they had been on hunger strike and were very, very, very ill, they'd release them to get better again, then they'd rearrest them. So it was a systematic form to break them down. So I think, you know, and actually subsequently the force-feeding techniques they learnt, they went on to use in Northern Ireland. So that shows you that it was another form of political war that they were fighting against there.
Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, a new film that focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. It takes place in 1912 and 1913. And Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. The film is now playing in Bay Area theaters. Unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls because this is a pre-taped Your Call. But I hope you can see this film. And you can also check out the trailer right under this show online at yourcallradio.org. What was it like for you to learn about the militant movement and, you know, like you said, firebombing post boxes and throwing rocks through windows at a time when there's the UK Uncut in the UK, for example? It's a huge movement. You've got Occupy UK at a time when a lot of citizens today feel like peaceful efforts are not making a difference. What was it like for you to...
Yeah,
kind of
we were interested in exploring what pushed these women to that point. I mean, again, I think it's really important to emphasize the fact that they never harmed human life or targeted human life, but they did use direct action as a way of getting press attention and their cause heard. But it was interesting that the parallels there are with groups that have turned to direct action. As you say, there are many groups, not just in the UK.
Right.
I think one of the things that was really interesting to us was on the premiere in London, we arrived in, you know, our stretch limos, and effectively, you know, what we do is entertainment, and suddenly seeing this incredible protest by Sisters Uncut, which was a group protesting against cuts to services for women who experienced domestic violence, you know, that felt like the spirit of the suffragette went on. And, you know, I think we all felt we couldn't have staged it better, because they had these incredible smoke bombs in the suffragette colours, and you know, it was in a weird way, that was what the film was sort of is a cry for, is to, you know, don't be afraid of standing up for something you believe in.
And you have screened the film to a number of focus groups, and you've had conversations. What has come up around this issue, just in terms of what it takes to actually create real change?
Yes, well, it's been exciting to see that the film has prompted a discourse, and we're really engaged in, we want to engage in that discourse. You know, there's a discourse around the lack of women in film. There's a discourse around the issues about inequality that are ongoing. There's a discourse about the lack of diversity. And I think that, you know, that's one of the good things that can come of this film. A positive discourse against, you know, showing that we need to continue the fight against inequality world over. And it's a fight that includes all women, in fact, and goes beyond, you know, just women, to men too, who are battling against issues of being treated unfairly and unequally.
Well, after the break, I'd like to talk to you about the men in the film. That is Sarah Gavron. She's director of Suffragette, a new film that focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. It takes place in 1912 and 1913. Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, and the film is now playing in Bay Area theaters. And unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls because this is a pre-taped Your Call, and we'll be back after this. Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are talking about a new film, Suffragette, which focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. It takes place in 1912 and 1913, and it is now playing in Bay Area theaters, and you can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette. Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette, and they worked previously together on a film adaptation of Monica Ali's book, Brick Lane. Let's talk about the men in Suffragette. I read that some of the agents actually rebuffed you when you were trying to cast men for this role, saying that the parts were not big enough. Is that true?
Well, we ended up with our, actually, luckily, we ended up with our dream cast for the film in terms of the men, with Brendan Gleeson, who's a phenomenal actor, and Ben Whishaw and Sam West and Finbar Lynch. But the journey to casting those men was interesting because, you know, Abby had created these complex and nuanced roles for the men that reflected the diverse sort of views of men at that time, from the sympathisers to the people who opposed votes for women. But, you know, nevertheless, women were at the centre of the film. And some of the agents in our early, when we were putting out the script for the male roles, would ring back and say, there's not really enough for the men to do. They're just kind of reacting. They're the husband. And our producer said, welcome to the world of actresses.
But, you know, I think it was interesting in a way because it made us really test those supporting roles when we looked at them again. And we said, OK, you know, I don't like films where an actress comes on and just sort of chops carrots in the background while her husband goes out and saves the world. So it was really important, as Sarah said, they were complex. And also they're such fine actors. You wanted to be able to use every bit of their brilliance. And so, you know, we tried to create men who were conflicted about their roles, were questioning their roles, as Inspector Steed questioning the law, or Sonny, a man born out of his time and realising that his wife in many ways is stronger than he is. and he can't deal with society's scorn, or even the character of Hugh Ellen, who would have been a member of the Men's League at the time, which of course was supporting the suffragettes, and you know, a number of those men were incarcerated as well, and we wanted to create that character who himself was struggling with the emotional toll that it was taking on, and physical toll it was taking on his wife, played by Helena Bonham Carter. So actually that was part of the joy of writing this, is to try and write supporting roles that were complex and were important and were essential. And, you know, although it, of course it is a female-led project, no film can work entirely on one sex. It's about the dialogue and the ensemble of them all. So it was great to work with those actors.
His name escapes me, but the man who was in charge of the surveillance and putting the team together.
Brendan Gleeson.
So it was so interesting to watch that role, and maybe it was my own feeling that he actually had a change of heart throughout the film, because he reached out, and I don't want to give anything away, but it's so worth seeing, that he reached out to Maud to become an informant, and she basically stood up to him. I mean, here is this woman who at one point was doing the laundry and going home and taking care of her son and her husband. And yet she did this sort of 180 and became this amazing activist and wrote him a letter. And it seems like it really got to him.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the character was he was based on these two detectives at the time. And it really added to it for us that he was Irish, as one of those detectives were at the time in the composites we drew from, because he was able to arrive with this huge backstory, which was he'd obviously grown up in a conflict time, he'd grown up in a time of troubles, and he understood what it meant for young women who were the foot soldiers, who were the hod carriers, as he referred to. And he knows the consequence of that level of despair and that level of what it means to be ostracized from society and how it will drive somebody to the absolute ends. And so I think he feels huge sense of probably being complicit in that because of the surveillance operations. And, you know, again, I think part of one's job as a dramatist is to never allow one character to be one-dimensional. Otherwise, you give them no sense of inner collusion and complexity. And so it's a mark of Brendan that he's able to track that so beautifully in the character of Inspector Steed. But also, it was about creating somebody who had this huge backstory that he brings to the table when he first meets Maud.
There's a lot of information about what the women think of this movement and how they've been affected by the movie. What about the men? What have you heard from the male actors or the men who've seen the film?
Well, it's been really invigorating and exciting to see the response of audiences, you know, particularly that younger people have responded. No one anticipated that we'd have this wave of support from the younger audience, and that, and on test screenings, they were all ticking the box inspiring. So I think it sort of somehow made them feel they could reconnect with politics. And we're hoping that with an election coming up here, that it can be a tool for discussion around the importance of the vote. But what's striking is that it's not just young women responding, it's also young men. But we've also had older men, you know, we've had older men talking about how they care about their grandchildren. And I think that people are realizing that women's rights, you know, as has been said many times, are human rights, that equality is good for everybody, that it's important that boys learn this story as much as it's important that girls do.
And what were your thoughts making this film just about voting today? What is voter turnout like in the UK? Because unfortunately here, it's pretty dismal. In fact, in California, 6.5 million people who are eligible to vote are not registered.
I think it's not dissimilar in the UK. I mean, we have a dwindling and disillusioned voting public, and we have particularly a very disillusioned young voting public, and particularly young women. And as we, you know, we've talked about often over the last few days, is that the problem is that then the parties stop creating policies because they know that group of people aren't voting. So they're not creating policies that affect young people to support them. They're actually creating them for those voters who will vote for them because they need their vote. And that's the difficulty, is that if you don't use your vote, then you don't get included in the discussions around how you can change the world. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to get a young audience to engage with, and in fact all people to engage with, which is we're so lucky to have our vote, and it's such a vital part of any democracy, and that if you can use your vote, then you can change policy, and if you can change policy, you can change law. And so that's sort of the message we're trying to send, and I think it's a global issue. I think that's the point of the roll call that we have at the end of the film, where you see all the different countries and how they are starting to vote. And I think it's no surprise that, you know, Saudi Arabia is 2015 and women have just registered their votes for the municipal councils, but the fact is those women still can't drive themselves to the polling booth. They still have to be driven by men. But if they get that vote, maybe that law can change. So it's happening now. It's relevant now.
What was going through your mind, Sarah?
Yes, I mean, it was exactly as Abby says. I mean, it was very striking when we looked at how life changed for women when they got the vote. So very tangibly, in 1918, when some women got the vote, and then in 1921, when all women got the vote, there was so much legislation that suddenly was passed that really transformed these women's lives, gave them rights for the first time over their children, allowed them to sit on juries, to be solicitors, to get rights over their own money. Life changed. It didn't go far enough. We still got a lot of fronts we need to carry on battling on.
Right, but those laws changed almost immediately?
Yes, really, within, you know, 2 to 3 years, there was a whole lot of legislation changing the lives of women.
How did that happen?
Well, that was because women were represented, so the government realised they needed to look after them.
Because they finally had a voice,
yeah,
and
exactly.
said, we're going to vote you out if you don't pass these laws.
I mean, it was very interesting to us because we recently went into the Houses of Parliament. We were shown around and we were able to go into the archives to look at where they keep all the acts that have ever been written. And that is incredibly moving. And they go back right back from the 12th century, some of these acts. And they're all these scrolls of papyrus and parchment where they've been written on. And you are reminded that, you know, one law can change the course of history.
Yeah.
And the fattest ones tend to be the tax laws and the thinnest ones tend to be the divorce laws. You know?
Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, a new film that focuses on the fight for the women's right to vote in the UK. It takes place in 1912 and 1913. The film is now playing in Bay Area theaters. And Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. And what was it like for you to convince people to fund the film?
The situation is that there are so few films made by women with women in heads of department roles each year, you know, directing one of the areas where there are even fewer than other areas, but there aren't very many writers. So 1 to 10% of films each year are directed by women. So this was an unusual proposition. It was not only a film made by women, but it was about women and it was about politics. So it wasn't an easy sell, but we found our champions. We found people that recognised that it was an engaging human story, that recognised that it could reach a broad audience, potentially resonate with what's going on in the world today. We talked about it as a kick-ass movie that would have chases and there were explosions, and it wasn't just women sitting in boardrooms talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest battle was, you know, that Sarah's managed to construct, you know, 5 very big set pieces within the film, and it was trying to fight to ensure that the film didn't get reduced. It was $40 million to make the film, which sounds like a lot of money, but actually it's not a lot of money when you have to, you know, have a huge scene in Epsom Derby or a riot in Parliament or even a huge act of civil disobedience in Oxford Street. And so it was all about trying to keep the ambition and the landscape of the film as big as we could.
When we do shows about books or music or film, I like to also talk about the art and the creative process. I feel like because we're inundated with so much, we just take documentaries and films and books for granted because we have so much information now. But your blood, sweat, and tears goes into this, and you spent 6 years researching and working on the script. And you just mentioned the sets. And Sarah, I mean, it was a beautiful film. The lighting, just the clothing, just the streets. I mean, you felt like you were taken back in time. So what was that process like?
Yeah, well, we assembled this team who really did an enormous amount of research and then created this world that was incredibly vivid, you know, the world of 1912. And we tried to find real locations wherever possible. Our most exciting location that we got access to was the Houses of Parliament, which no film crew ever has before.
Oh, how'd you do that?
Well, I said to the location manager, we've got to be very suffragette about this. We've got to petition them until they agree. And they had decided that they were considering opening themselves up to commercial filmmaking. And so they opened their doors to us, and we put in this very ambitious request to stage an anti-government protest in their courtyard with 300 supporting artists and stunt people. And they allowed us to do that, which was a marker of how progress has happened. And then we closed off a central London street to stage this breaking of the windows, which had been this protest that happened in 1912. And we found a corner of East London that we could film in. And then, you know, we created the Derby. So it was all a challenge, and there were lots of visual effects involved. But the kind of overriding idea was that we'd create something that felt very authentic and real and didn't distance you. It wasn't like a sort of standard period drama where you admire its beauty.
Right, because a lot of it was dark and some of it was sort of grey in a way, which I think added to it.
Yeah, I mean, the world of that time was, you know, I mean, there were some beautiful bits. You know, the Derby days were very gloriously sort of sunny, as they were at the time. But the world of the laundry in East London in winter was dark. And so we tried to recreate that as it was.
Let's talk a little bit more about Maud, a working class woman who works in the laundry with one son, and her husband is not happy with the decisions that she's made. And she's a fictional character. How did you develop her character? What was it based on?
It was based on a composite of women's voices that we started to, and the lives that we started to read about through, you know, the testimonials that were written for the deputation that day that you see at the core of the film, from police interviews that came out of the declassified police records, from historians who talked about the life of the working class women, through to the medical historians who talked about the effects of the working life on these women. So I think it was a desire to try and create a character who in herself was fictional, but actually the place she came from was utterly authentic. And, you know, it was very shocking to me to discover that a woman had some rights to her children up until that child was seven. But as soon as that child turned seven, then the rights revert entirely to the father. And that was the significance of her taking a present to George on his seventh birthday, you know. And so that was very resonant. But also the realization that so many of these women, like Maud, were illiterate. They would have been at school until they were nine, then the act changed till they were 12. But part of that would have been part-time if they went to school at all. And so it was the desire to realize that history doesn't necessarily get changed by the exceptional people. It gets changed by the ordinary people. And I think we wanted to, in an age of global inequality, we wanted to create a woman who was a quiet role model for the world, who, you know, looked like she was an innocent observer on the world, and actually through engaging with herself and her own journey then starts to engage with a desire to change history along the way, and the sacrifice of that, you know. And it seemed so apparent when you looked at the lives of these women, you know, so many of them who had their children taken away. I mean, there's one example of a woman whose mother-in-law tried to take away her three children. I mean, literally kidnapped them. So, you know, just because she didn't believe in her, this woman's right to be a suffragette. And so I think the other thing that is going on within the film is the huge anti-suffragette movement, not only from Westminster and the discourse of the media, but amongst women themselves.
Mm. What did you learn about that? Because that's always fascinating to explore.
Well, I think this thing that's shocking is that the women would have been, you know, photographed, and then these photos were published in the press, and how, what, you know, the shame of that, and the way there's a line where Sonny says, "We've been cast out," and the fact that these women were often cast out in society. I mean, they had a secret code. They used to write in code with each other. They'd send postcards. They had jewellery and the colours that were in the colours of the suffragette movement, so that they were indicating to each other they were in the movement. So much of what they did, you know, was underground and kept quiet. So it's a mark of how, again, how much these women jeopardised to be part of this movement.
There were men who were obviously opposed to it, but there were groups of women who were opposed to it, and that was sort of shocking to see. And in fact, Helena Bonham Carter, who plays one of the suffragettes, her own grandmother, who was called Violet Asquith, who was the child of Herbert Asquith, who was the Prime Minister at the time, who was so opposed to women's suffrage. So she had this lineage which was extraordinary. But her grandmother, Violet, was very opposed to votes for women too, because she lived in this privileged world where she didn't really have an insight into how it was for the ordinary women. But I think there were many women who just felt it was challenging. You know, they'd imbibed this idea that women should stay in the home and not be part of the political sphere.
Were you able to find any articles about the women who opposed the right to vote and what their reactions were after they got it?
We were recently in the House of Parliament. We looked at some anti-suffrage badges, which are actually rather pretty. You know, there was a huge movement who would go along when these women were protesting and give out flyers. And there was a vocal, you know, these were often the wives of the men as well who were protesting against them, the wives of MPs. But then there were also some, you know, as we see in the film, you know, the Romola Garai character, Alice, is a woman who's married to an MP and would have been absolutely at the forefront of those dinner party conversations where the women, you know, the men and the women around the table would have derided the movement because it was so threatening to the status quo.
Abby Morgan is screenwriter of Suffragette, a film that focuses on the women's right to vote in the UK, the fight for the right to vote. The film is now playing in Bay Area theaters, and Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. Unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls because this is a pre-taped Your Call. And I wanted to ask you, Sarah, you wrote a piece in response to Helema Manin's opinion article, Why I Am Reluctant to Watch Suffragette. And it's about why the film focuses on white women and why there are no women of color in the film. And you write that all along you were aware that a lot was left out of the film. I mean, you've got about 2 hours. But talk a little bit about your reaction to some of this criticism that it's a very white focus film?
Well, the first cinema film I made with Abby was called Brick Lane, and it only had people of colour as cast members, not a single white member of the cast, and it was focused on this woman as a protagonist. So one of our missions is to put people you don't normally see on screen, so we're very aware of it. We're also very aware of how different the US movement was from the UK movement, particularly in this respect. There were many, many women of colour involved in the US movement, some who were included and some who were excluded. And there were horrific and difficult episodes, like Ida B. Wells, a well-known suffragette who was forced to march at the end of the march in one episode. And, that, you know, awful things happened that were divisive and have left long-lasting wounds. But in the UK movement, it was a very different picture because we didn't have immigration and the level that we had it later. And so the brilliantly diverse Britain we have today happened because of the immigration around the First and Second World War, but primarily because of the immigration around the 1950s and onwards. So at the time of the UK suffragette movement, there were only tiny pockets of immigrant communities. And what we found when we interrogated the photographic and written evidence was that there were only two women of colour that are known about that were involved in the movement, and they were both aristocratic women. The most well-known is Sophia Dulip Singh, and she's going to have a television programme made about her. We were focusing very much on the working women who were hugely marginalised, and we felt that telling their story was really vital. So that was the picture. There is one photograph that it happens before our time period starts in 1911, a peaceful march around the coronation where there's a contingent of women from India marching. And that, and obviously there were a lot of women in India fighting for women's rights as well as for a free India. And there were lots of women around the globe engaged in their own struggles for the movement. But we were reflecting what we found in the UK. But what we want is for the film to reach all women today across cultures all over the world. And what's been exciting is being open to the discourse. And obviously there's a huge discourse around diversity in front of and behind the camera. And I'm passionate that we don't only redress that horrible imbalance in terms of the lack of women behind the camera, but we also redress the balance in terms of people from different backgrounds in, behind the camera, because then we'll start reflecting the stories of our day.
What are your thoughts, Abby?
I mean, I'm totally in agreement with what Sarah says, but also I think in many ways the discussions that it's raised, is that there is, it's exposed that there are many stories. And the US suffragette movement was extraordinary, and as Sarah said, you know, it was a very complex picture, and it moved through the abolitionist period into the civil rights movement, and women's rights has run parallel with that. And there were so many extraordinary women, including women of colour, like Sojourner Truth and Ida B. Wells that Sarah mentioned. And to have and see films about those women would be really, really exciting. Mm-hmm. I think what's important to us is, as Sarah said, it's reiterating that this is a film about equality for all women and empowering all women, and that any other narrative on it, it would be distracting to that, but it's certainly something we need to keep talking about, and we're really, really happy to keep talking about.
And did the information about these, the few women of colour who took part, did that come up in your research?
Oh, yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
No, absolutely. We were aware of those two aristocratic women, and we were aware of this contingent of women from India that happened before our time. But the vast majority, they were from diverse backgrounds. I mean, class at that time was the big issue that was dividing society in the UK, because we hadn't yet had our waves of immigrants.
Mm. And have you received a response to this?
Yeah, she wrote. Piece? She wrote acknowledging that I'd written it and thanking me for writing it. So that's good.
And do you get many questions about this when you do your...
We get questions
screening
in the US, yeah, because obviously
it's huge
the,
right
the,
now.
Huge issue of the day, and rightly so, and needs to be really, really interrogated and addressed.
Yeah, I think it's been good for us because it's been, you know, in a way, it's given us the opportunity to talk about it, and anything that draws light to that, anything that draws light to, and allows people to actually also talk about the US suffragette movement, which is really important, and to reclaim that for all women of all colours, then it's really, really vital.
Right.
But you want, what you do want is that you want women to engage with and go to see this film, because what's striking is it's difficult to make films like this made. It's difficult to make political films. It's difficult to make films about women and made by women. And unless people show that there's an appetite for films like this, they won't continue to be made.
What is the difference between the influence and the power that women filmmakers have in the UK versus the US?
It's hard for us to judge that. We're only operating in the UK, although we've had some fantastic American distributors who have and developers who have worked alongside us. But certainly in the UK, the statistics are very low. But I think they also are in the US. I think there's similar. It's similar small.
Yeah, and I think what's fascinating is that the numbers don't add up across the board. You know, we know this magic 17% that everyone keeps talking about, which is 17% of women in boardrooms, 17% of women in law. I mean, I was recently on a panel for gender equality in the media that Gina Davis runs, which is extraordinary. And they've done some fascinating research also about the representation of women on screen and the fact that actually it's the see it to be it. And so they can see a direct correlation between college places and the careers that women are taking up actually correlates to the representation in terms of money, numbers of those careers on screen. And so one of the things that they found extraordinary is that the numbers are pretty low on things like the legal and the academic and judicial system, but it seems like criminal forensic psychology is really high for women. It's something like 75% of places on that course is being taken by women. And it's no surprise that CSI is also, you know, it has comparisons that they have great female forensic psychologists in that. So I think it's interesting for us because certainly as a writer, it makes me think I have to start to write the world to change the world.
Hmm. What is it like for the both of you coming from the UK? You're in the United States doing a press tour and talking to a lot of people. And before the show, I was telling you about all of the attacks on abortion and reproductive rights. What is it like for you to come to this country and learn that every Republican candidate running for president is opposed to abortion, even in cases of rape and incest? So many clinics are closing. Women in South Texas have to cross the border to get the morning after pill. What goes through your mind when you hear this?
Shock. I mean, it's, you know, this is a country where you expect it to be more progressive than that. And the fact that it seems to be moving backwards is shocking. And it shows how vital it is that women vote and how vital it is that women campaign and get their voices heard. And those issues are at the forefront of politics.
And that we keep talking about it, you know, that we don't, because I think you have to re-engage with that. And, you know, it is a shocking statistic. And I think it makes us self-reflect. I was talking to somebody recently. I didn't realize that your maternal maternity laws are so shocking that a woman only has 6 weeks after she's had a baby to hold on to her job, and after that it's open to being taken by someone else. So I think for us it's always about cross-fertilization of ideas and about, you know, so many of the issues that you're dealing with, you know, are shocking to us, really, really shocking to us. But that's not to say we don't have our own shocking facts.
No, we have many.
You know, and so it's, you know, I think for us it's just fascinating and a privilege to be able to take this film and hope it can land and have resonance globally, not only in the US. Certainly it's happening in the UK at the moment. It's hitting this zeitgeist, whatever it is, but we just hope globally it will start to affect and create conversations like this around all women's issues, and that's what's important.
Is abortion divisive at all in the UK?
Well, there are pockets of resistance that come from the right-wing government, but not in the same way as here.
You know, you're state-led. It's very, very different. You know, we're fundamentally smaller. You know,
right.
And we don't. You know, it's a very different culturally. It's very, very different. But we definitely have pockets. We definitely have, you know, pro-life pockets. But it doesn't seem to be in the way, and it doesn't seem to have the judicial and legal power that it has over here in terms of controlling women's, you know, own right to their own birth control.
But we certainly do have many issues.
Yes, we read about them. We've also been reading about Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating new period in our history.
Yeah. I loved the end of the film when you scroll down and you had the names of different countries and the year in which women got the right to vote. And the film is now open in the Bay Area. Is it going to open in other countries? And what are your hopes for those openings?
Yes, no, it has been sold widely, and we hope it will have as far a reach as possible, because there are so many issues that are resonant world over that it brings up. And so we'd love it to get into the Middle East. We'd love it to get into India, you know, all sorts of areas where sometimes it's harder to get these mainstream
films.
We'd
love it to get into Switzerland, because they only got the vote in 1971.
That always elicits a gasp from the audience when you get the statistic that, the fact that 1971 was when women got the vote in Switzerland.
Right. Abby Morgan is the screenwriter of Suffragette, and Sarah Gavron is director of Suffragette. The film is now playing in Bay Area theaters. I hope you can see it. Bring your sons, your brothers, your uncles, cousins, your daughters. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Abby and Sarah, thank you both for coming in.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast our conversation with artists about the 21st annual Oakland Museum's Day of the Dead exhibition, Rituals and Remembrance. It explores how Latin American, Filipino, Hawaiian, African American, and others view death, memory, and healing. How do you remember your ancestors? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.